Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 19.
Altitude.
Tower, Delaware Spaces, release to you, runway 411, 0040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude, zero eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
And give a geographical area. This, we were on the outskirts of Belgrade, kind of west of Belgrade, heading north, and they called a SAM launch and over Belgrade. And I knew I was kind of close, but I was a little offset to the west. So I kind of looked to my right over to Belgrade, and this huge, you know, looks like a Saturn V thing, you know, arching up. I'm on my target run. I'm about, you know, I'm probably, not exactly, 30, 45 seconds before my bomb was supposed to drop. And it was an antenna, and I kind of had it doped out pretty well as I'm going, so I had a little time. So I look over, and I see this missile coming up, and I knew my number two guy was over there somewhere, you know, and then I see another launch.
That is the voice of my guest today, retired Lieutenant Colonel Charlie Hainline, call sign Tuna. We flew Heritage Flight together. That's where we first met. Tuna is a phenomenal human being. In that segment, he is talking about his F-117 days. On that sortie, he earned a Distinguished Flying Cross. I'll be honest, we don't talk in great detail about that on this episode. There's still things about it that are classified, but it is still an interesting story. Tuna has flown nearly everything underneath the sun. His military aircraft include the A-10, the F-18, the F-117, and the F-4. He is a Warbird pilot. We'll talk about that. He also is a Warbird restorer. Tuna is quite an accomplished individual. I think you'll enjoy this episode. Before we get rolling, if you're enjoying it, please head over to iTunes, hit like, subscribe, and leave me a rating or review. That will help me out. All right, with that been knocked out, let's get into the episode with Tuna. Hope you enjoy the episode. Tuna, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Excited to have you on here and talk a little bit about your aviation career.
Good to be here.
So can we start with just a little elevator pitch of who you are and the 30-second snapshot of your career, which is going to be really tough to do, and then we're going to dig into it.
Gotcha. Charlie Hainline, Lieutenant Colonel, retired USAF. Started out flying civilian, got my license, went in the Air Force around 1986, and then went to pilot training at Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma, then to the A-10 in Korea, and then Louisiana, then to the F-117, a little bit at Tonopah, but mostly at Holloman Air Force Base, and then to a Navy exchange flying F-18 Hornets, and then back to Holloman to fly the F-117 again. And then I flew F-4s with the German Air Force based at Holloman as well, and then walked over to cross the ramp to the drone F-4s at Holloman. That was my career, then got out and joined Southwest Airlines, where I recently retired.
Congratulations.
Thank you. great to be there.
Big smile on his face. Yeah. I love it.
Absolutely.
I don't want to just, you know, completely, you know, skip over the A-10 because it would make Shiv feel bad, but I did have an interview with him and he talked about it. I haven't talked to anyone who flew the F-117, which to me is like really fascinating. You had to be kind of in the beginning wave, if I'm doing my math right, based on your age, and I'm pretty good with math. But yeah, were you kind of the initial cadre or showing up soon into that wave?
I would say I was that early. I was probably that next wave after. It was kind of right when it came out of the black is about when I got into it. So not real early, but not real late. I got into it in 1992. So it was just after the Gulf War. And I got there. Basically, we still had a detachment flying out of Khamis Mouche in Saudi Arabia that we rotated through every 3 months. And so I did. I missed the big Gulf War, but I did get to fly one mission over Iraq post Gulf War in 1990. Let me see, early 93. That was not very well advertised, but we went and dropped some bombs. They were shooting in the no-fly zone, you know, and we destroyed some of their surface-to-air stuff, so.
That's wild. What was it like flying the stink bug?
It was, you know, it was really interesting, no doubt. I mean, it was, you know, it was a different mission that a normal fighter pilot was used to, I guess. Kind of more of a bomber role, you know. And we were called ourselves attack because it's cooler than the bomber role. But it was really basically a bomber, you know, a straight line, two bomb, stealthy mission. But it was really interesting and the neat thing was, is, you know, if there's something going on in the world, we were on the hook, you know, to go. And that was exciting and pretty cool. So, but there's a lot of night flying, a lot of single ship, you know, and which is not great, but yeah, it's overall interesting. For one tour, maybe two tours was a little overkill. But
yeah, you loved it so much, you had to go back after flying the Hornet.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was the all-volunteer Air Force, and I non-volunteered to that. But anyway, it was great. I'm glad I did it. It all worked out great.
Oh, that's awesome. So you weren't a volunteer for that, but I mean, that was, again, it was kind of popping up, and I guess they were pulling guys from all different weapon systems to kind of go fill it.
Yeah, so I was a volunteer the first time I went. That was actually, back then it was kind of a process. It was an application, letters of recommendation, stuff like that. So it was a little more involved, and then you got chosen to go. And then later, a couple, maybe 2 or 3 years after I got in, they kind of turned it into a normal assignment process, like any other fighter. You know, you just get assigned or volunteer or whatever. So, yeah. But when I went, it was just when they're leaving Tonopah, going down to Holloman, and I got in. I did some of my training up at Tonopah, but most everything down at Holloman.
Was it challenging flying that, or was it just?
Nope. No. It had its challenging parts. The airplane was very a nice airplane to fly. I mean, it didn't accelerate very well because of the exhaust, you know. but it was nicely set up. Had a great autopilot. It flew well. You know, they called it the Wobbly Goblin. That's just because it's kind of unstable, but it was no big deal. I mean, it was just kind of wallered around sometimes at different air speeds, but it was easy to fly. And the mission was probably one of the most difficult things, is, believe it or not, air-to-air refueling, just from the aspect of finding a tanker and joining with the tanker. We didn't have radar. We didn't even have air-to-air attack in for a long time. And so it was a point parallel, you know, timing. You know, if you had a good tanker crew, it was pretty easy. If you didn't, it was tough. Or if you're the second guy to the tanker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that could be a challenge. And the cockpit was set up not to do visual stuff. I mean, so there's a lot of reflection from the flat planes of glass. So at night, it was difficult to see out and find the tanker. And then, you know, to maneuver was not easy, especially if you had a two ship with you. But,
yeah, that's something I'm just thinking about, flying formation with that. So no air-to-air TACAN initially. So for those who don't know, like being able to get ranges from other aircraft airborne. But did you fly with NVGs?
No, not until later. And I missed that. So that came after I left the second time even. So my whole first tour was no NVGs. And most of my second tour, well, all of it really was, but they were just getting it as I left the second tour. So
So how do you find the tanker at night with no air-to-air TACAN when they goof up point parallel?
Right. Well, a lot of luck. Some trying to build SA. You know, hey, where are you? I flew in combat in Bosnia, so there we had the four corners of the tanker track labeled. You know, the northeast corner would be Maine, the northwest corner would be Oregon, kind of like that. So where are you? Oh, I'm over Oregon. Okay, so I'd head over that direction, you know, and hopefully see him out there. But the problem is some brilliant senior officer decided, we'll paint tankers really dark and put very few lights on them because I don't know why. But
keep it tactical.
Keep real tactical because, you know, of course, we're over friendly territory trying to find this guy. And our mission depends on that. So anyway, so 135s were terribly hard to find. KC-10s were a little easier. But a lot of it was SA. And then later on when they got Pacer Craig in the tankers, then we'd let them join on us a lot of the time. So it helped a little bit. But it was no doubt difficult. And even the best guys, you know, had issues. You know, it's just hard to do at night, you know, and especially in weather, which – of course, tankers are always in the weather, so
they always find the one cloud.
So hopefully there's not any tanker guys listening.
Yeah, they should, because they always find the one cloud.
Oh, it's amazing. It's incredible. I remember one time in the A-10 being refueling in the weather, and then when I was done, they gave me a clearance to climb, and I climbed literally 500 feet, and I was in the clear.
Right.
So I go, up, there you go, standard.
Yeah, I think I'm sure everyone has a story like that. Because I remember there was one time in Iraq, I was refueling, and it was just like a shark's tail sticking above the weather.
Exactly.
You're like, if we just climbed 10 feet even,
exactly,
we would be in the clear, and my life would be so much nicer right now.
That's right. That's within the error of the altimeter, is 10 right. feet. I mean, it's legal.
Yeah. That's right. Oh, no. This is what we're assigned. Well, could we ask for something different? You know? No.
Nah, you know.
It's character building.
Hard. Yeah, it is. Yeah, so that was a challenge. The other challenge of 117 was, depending on, it was kind of a mental thing to where, you know, all our imagery was, I'd say all, but 90% was taken from a satellite view, basically straight down on top of the target. When we're coming in at a slant range, you know, we're coming in at a flat angle. So until we get right directly over the target, everything's looking forward and down a little bit. So you had to kind of translate that satellite image of your target to what you're going to see in the sensors. And that for some people was harder than others, depending on how your mind is, or, you know,
right.
Left brain, right brain, or whatever. It was kind of hard to do. They gave us offsets and stuff, which you probably had in the Viper as well, to tighten things up. But when I started out, our INS was a B-52 INS, which spun beryllium steel balls for its gyroscopic, you know, thing or something. And it was pretty good for that type of INS, but it was not GPS updated then. It was nothing. It was so...
It's good when you need a carpet bomb.
Right. Exactly. Back in Nam, it worked just fine.
Not when you need to drop one bomb through a stovepipe.
That's right. Not so much. So we'd update that on... Here in the States, we do it on TACANs, actually TACAN stations, because they're very well referenced, you know, as
right.
far as geographically. So they're very accurately referenced. So we could put all, you know, four digits of coordinates in there. I mean, four past the decimal point, and do an offset, and then find the TACAN, and then update on the TACAN itself. And that would help. But
was it a pretty good drift rate in that INS?
It could be. Some were pretty good, but as they got older, they got worse, of course, and it would drift. You know, you'd want on a normal stateside training mission, which would be maybe an hour and a half all around, you know, just civilian targets out in New Mexico or whatever, you'd want probably two updates in that hour and a half at least to
wow.
help you. Yeah, they'd plan for that. Of course, in, you know, combat, there's not, you know, they don't have a lot of TACANs out there that we got. Surveyed. So
strange.
The bad yeah, guys
didn't give yeah. good reference points to update, you know, the weapons.
That's
systems.
Right. Yeah. So it's a little different.
That's one thing too, thinking about, you know, all the combat I flew. I mean, it's mostly close air support, so you're wheeling mm-hmm. it up and doing
yeah.
a target talk on, and there's time to like figure out for the most part what building is what, but predominantly in F-117, it's fly the black line, drop the bombs, and turn and go, like minimize your footprint in the enemy territory.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, our defense was stealth and flying the planned route or route. So that included many altitude changes. So from a profile view of our route, it was you know, very zigzaggy, you know, up and down, up and down, up and down, and left and right and left and right. And that was to, you know, because we weren't invisible, we were low observable. So
right.
on the especially on the double digit SAMs, are really good Soviet SAMs and the good operators, you had to really avoid them. So our routes would take us around them and change altitudes to spoof the missiles. So our routes were very random looking, you know, but very, very well planned out by the mission planners. So,
yeah. I know this is your second tour. We'll jump back to the Hornet, but Kosovo, that was involved in your second tour in the stink bug. I envisioned Tina right. just kicking the door down, going into Kosovo. What was Kosovo like?
It was interesting. We flew from Spangdahlem, Germany. So we had our squadron. I was in the 9th Fighter Squadron, and the 8th Fighter Squadron flew out of Aviano, Italy. So they had a pretty short trip there. Ours was about 2+ hours to get down to the tanker track, which was over Hungary and Budapest area, and then fly our mission, which was maybe 30, 45 minutes, depending on what it was, and then tank, and then get drugged back home. So they're about a 6-hour evolution, takeoff to landing there. So it was pretty grueling, you know. they're long, long missions. So, but it was great being out of Spain. All, you know, it's very nice. We had good accommodations.
Full per diem, I'm sure.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, thank Food you. Food was good. Thank you for your service. So just one pre-vol tank into the target area, and then probably mm-hmm. one post-vol, and then you're on your way home.
That's right. Yeah, we pre-tanked and you know, hung on the tanker until our individual time. So there were 2 airplanes per tanker. And I think we usually had 3 different tanker tracks, with, 4 airplanes, 2 tankers, 4 airplanes ish, you know, sometimes another one depending on. And, so we go 2 ship to the tanker, get drugged down there to the track, orbit, fuel, and wait until our TOT, came up, and then we stealth up and leave the tanker track, go do our thing and come back. Stealth, try to find the tanker, and then fingers crossed that all works. And it sometimes almost didn't work. I've knew stories, buddies of mine that were just moments from diverting before they could find the tanker. So it was, I don't think anyone had to. I think everyone eventually did it, but it was pretty, pretty skosh sometimes.
Yeah, nothing like just riding on fumes and trying to make it happen. Like those are like the most stressful times, at least for me.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And you don't want to be that guy, you know. Nobody does.
Don't want a new call sign out of this.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The one I got's bad enough.
On those Kosovo sorties, I mean, was it just, again, just flying the black line and dropping 2 bombs and heading home? Was that the normal battle rhythm for you guys?
It was, yeah, and sometimes we had 2 targets. Most of the time, both bombs were dropped on a single target, and we were fried against a lot of different, actually. A lot of communication stuff, antennas, big, tall transmission antennas. We got, that was kind of a new thing, and they go, hey, can you take out a, you know, big, tall, 2,000-foot antenna? And go, well, maybe, so we'd try it, and we'd drop at the base of the antenna, and tumble it. That was kind of a new thing we didn't expect. Bridges, petroleum, POL, whatever that stands for, petroleum lubricants.
Those facilities, yada, yada, they're gas.
That's right.
No oil.
I remember I'm retired. different buildings, you know, factories, you know, if they found intel on, you know, some high level, you know, people hiding away, we drop on them. And
this is going to sound weird, But dropping on TV antennas or antennas in general, that had to be kind of a tough thing to find in the sensor, I would imagine.
Exactly. Very, very, very difficult. It was some of them some of them were huge. I mean, some of them were, had this big ball on the top of them, you know, and it was a spire type thing, you know, and which was weird. But a lot of them were just those thin, like you see around, you know, around here, you know, just a lattice work metal deal that goes up. And in a high humidity, which back then our stuff was really, first generation FLIR.
Right.
Kind of, well, maybe second, but I mean, it wasn't like it is now, like the kids get now. You know?
Yeah, just nice. I can see that TV antenna for miles.
That's right. We had to tune and gain manually, and there was an auto setting, but it didn't work good enough. So high humidity, we had to manually adjust the gain of the FLIR to break out the target, which was, and it was grainy anyway.
Right.
So it was pretty test. I mean, you couldn't do it without an autopilot. It was, you know, you really either had to have another guy in the airplane, which nobody wants, or
I just threw up thinking about that.
or a good autopilot. So that, you know, you're on autopilot and really concentrate on the target, make sure you got it, and then tuning and gaining to increase the quality of the picture to where the laser, you know, gets a nice shot at it. And then it was difficult. It was really hard.
That's why I don't have a terrible amount of experience with the lantern pod, mostly sniper pod, which was nice. But even still, like on those long target run-ins, like it still could be, you know, 5, 6, 4 miles until you're almost to the target where you're like, no kidding, breaking everything out. And that's what it is, unless it's something just obvious, like a built, you know, 10 story building out in the middle of nowhere, right? Like you'll see that, but a TV antenna, that's something in my mind would be really challenging to hit.
It was. And we really depended on good offsets. So, you know, we'd click over to an offset, you know, a bridge or a big road intersection, find out that, come back. And that got to be where, you know, if you had good offsets, you know, you got to trust the system too. Sometimes you get a really late show, so you got to be patient. And, you know, you see the TTG on the display was time to go. TTI was time to impact. So TTG was when the bomb's going to go, you know. So you really got to have it doped out, you know, especially if it was a no collateral damage allowed deal, you know. So, boy, it got really intense there, you know, the short hairs, you know, to you feel the doors opening and go, oh, I'm pretty sure that's it, you know, and then the bomb goes away and then hopefully you got it.
Nailed it. So I want to say, I'll paint this picture here. You and I had flown a bunch together doing heritage flights. So that's a whole nother aspect too we can talk about, but you've fly a lot of warbirds and you've been doing it for a long time and you build and restore warbirds, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. So I'd say we had a history together. You had an engine failure while you're on my wing.
That's right.
Yeah. So just good times. So I'd say we'd been through a few things.
Yep.
But we were at an air show in Miami and your wife mentioned that you had a distinguished flying cross. So in all this time that I've known you, the things we've been through, you never once mentioned this, but to me, it's a very fascinating story because you've done a lot in your career and I think it's very admirable. But I would like you just to, if you could tell me a little bit about that sortie and what happened, because to me, it's fascinating. It's very humbling just to know you and call you a friend.
Oh, well, you're too kind. Way too kind.
You can pay me $20 later.
Yeah, that check's in the mail. it was an interesting night. And some of this, I don't know what has been declassified. So
fair enough.
Yeah, but generally, that way I can get away with anything. If I say that.
We're going to
generally,
the moon.
Yeah, we were on a target and the other F-117 in the cell, we had a kind of a parallel target run, but a ways off, you know, 10 miles parallel. I'm not like real close, but, we were getting targeted a lot by surface to air missiles. A lot of people don't understand how much, you know, it wasn't like those videos of the Gulf War where you see, you know, all this bullets spraying up in the air. It wasn't that, but there was actually quite a bit of AAA and at times, quite a few missiles being fired, SA-3 types and various others. So, anyway, we were
on a parallel track, and my wingman, or I can't remember if I was flight lead or the wingman, didn't really matter, but the CJ Viper guys would announce over one of our frequencies, you know, missile launch over, and give a geographical area. This, we were on the outskirts of Belgrade, kind of west of Belgrade, heading north, and they called a SAM launch and over Belgrade. And I knew I was kind of close, but I was a little offset to the west. And so I kind of looked to my right over to Belgrade, and this huge, you know, looks like a Saturn V thing, you know. I'm on my target run. I'm about, you know, I'm probably, I can't remember exactly, 30, 45 seconds before my bomb was supposed to drop. And it was an antenna, and I kind of had it doped out pretty well as I'm going. So I had a little time. So I look over and I see this missile coming up, and I knew my number two guy was over there somewhere, you know. And then I see another launch, and from the air, you've probably seen it, but you know, it's to see a surface air missile launch at night from the air, it's exactly what you'd expect. This big glow, and even from that far away, you can see a lot of detail, the plume of the, yeah, you know, the smoke going, and then you see that just this ball of fire, you know, coming up towards you.
This telephone pole, bigger than a telephone pole.
Yeah, exactly. In our defense, they say, you know, you can't click the autopilot off. The best defense is to do nothing.
Really?
Yeah, because turning or banking increases, maybe, you know, you just don't know what it's going to do to your cross section. So staying on that black line is your best. So they say, lower your seat.
Think skinny.
Yeah, think skinny, lower your seat, put a big map over your window so you can't see what's happening, and that's maybe the best idea. But so I'm going, and as I'm heading towards this target, one missile explodes, the other one kind of goes up into space, so I don't know if it hit him or, you know, because we had to have one shot down, you know, a while back. And
right.
So anyway, so we continue to our, by this time now, when I see that segment blow up, now I'm about, you know, a couple seconds before my bomb drops. So my door's open. I track my target and, go to the impact of the bomb and, blow that thing up and then clean up. And then I'm heading to the tanker track. And, I get there and I take my gas and my number two guy is nowhere to be found. And, we wait around and see, he just doesn't show up. And, interesting part was, circled and circled and circled, and the tanker guys say, we gotta go, you know, pretty quick, because they got fuel issues as well, you know, they're giving us gas, and they got to get back to, I think, Ramstein or Frankfurt, or I can't remember where they're flying up. But so I said, is it helpful if you put flaps down? I mean, is there something you can max range? I'll just hang out, you know, because I had pretty much topped off, so I had plenty of gas. And we can. I go, you can save some fuel for, you know, if he comes back, you know. And so they were calculating all that. And these were Sky Harbor Phoenix Guard guys. Really good.
Yeah.
Really professional, awesome tanker pilots. And they did save gas, and they ran around and, you know, conserved as much as we could. But we're sitting there, and all of a sudden the boomer says, hey, there's a 117 without lights on coming up to the pre-contact position. So, but his he couldn't tell if his door was open because he was out of lights. Well, as it turns out, whether the missile hit him or not, but the EMP, his airplane wasn't in really good shape, put it that way.
a little banged up.
Yeah. And so he goes, I go, put the pro, you know, stick the boom in, stick him and start putting gas in him. So he did, and he kind of fell off the boom and kind of drifted back. So we didn't know if he was single engine or what kind of problems he was having. So I kind of instructed the tanker, hey, can you, you know, come left, come right, put your flaps down, slow down. He might be having problems and this and that. And so he did, and we found him again, and he came back up, and they refueled him as well. And not all the gas was going in his airplane. Yeah. And anyway, that's about the size of the time. So I guess, you know, we just kind of worked together as a team to get him back. And he ended up making it back. He kind of disappeared again for a while, but he made it back to Spang Dong and lived to tell the tale. So I guess that's kind of the conclusion. I probably said too much.
We'll scrub it. There'll just be long bleeps in this podcast. But
yeah.
You know, there were some cool stories. That's wild. I know that would be incredibly challenging too, just flying on his wing and supporting him when you guys, again, are kind of limited as far as what you have compared to most fighters.
Exactly. Yeah, we're in a poor visibility, not a really well-designed cockpit for that kind of stuff, you know, and it was a challenge. So, yeah, it was a challenge to stay on the target run with missiles in the air, but and just to get him, kind of help him out and get him back. And Tanger was about to leave. He was going to say, we're out of here. So I guess it was my good, what's a good word for it? Convincing, you know, skills to manipulate and convince people to do things you want them to do.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, being a used car salesman.
It helps.
Don't sell yourself short.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
That aspect too, you're talking about like the target run. I think, I mean, most people probably can appreciate it. You know, an F-16 when doing the Wild Weasel mission, as people get, they're different tactics, right? It depends on the scenario and what the mission is, right? But as stuff starts going south, if you have the ability to defend yourself, we're going to start moving very quickly and pulling G's, trying to do it. So there's a lot to be said for just think skinny and keep driving straight on the black line. Like that's not, I wouldn't like doing that.
No. And it's easy when there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
But it's hard when there's stuff in the air. And that was the thing is, and I'm trying to think, I'd seen a missile launch when I did that mission over Iraq, you know, right post Gulf War, my first tour, you know, 117. So I'd kind of seen that, but it was just a little bit there. But, you know, this was, there's a lot more, you know, popping up but that was probably the first close up, you know, missile launch that I had seen, you know, so it was a little unnerving.
Always fun getting telephone poles shot at you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What could go wrong? Yeah,
this would be fun. This would be fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you telling that story. Just to kind of jump back in between there. You did a Hornet exchange with the Navy.
Right.
How was flying the Mighty Hornet?
Oh, it was great. I hate to say it was maybe my best tour I had in the Air Force was in the Navy, but
you weren't on a boat. You didn't go on the boat, did you?
Not for a cruise. No, I did get carrier qualified.
But you got to leave the carrier. That's the main thing.
I got after about 5 days, which was perfect because it's very exciting. It's a very neat atmosphere to be in for 5 days.
Yeah.
not 6 months. So yeah, I was, it couldn't have worked out better. So I went to VFA 106 at Cecil Field in 1995, and my assignment was to be RAG instructor, RTU, RAG, okay, replacement head group, so this, the schoolhouse that teach people. So I went through the whole long course, which included carrier qual. And they actually gave me the choice. I didn't have to get carrier qual, but yeah, I really wanted to.
That's awesome.
It was a great experience. So I went through that and got carrier qualed on the Constellation on the West Coast, actually. We flew all the way to the West Coast for that. And then became an instructor and instructor there for 3 years, which was fantastic. It was a great tour. I love the Hornet. It was a great airplane. I got maybe 6 hours in the F-16 at test pilot school when we took our F-4s there.
Yeah.
And grade flight. So I got a little F-16 time so I can compare it a little bit. But the Hornet was more conventional, I guess. You know, the Viper, as you know, side stick and stuff is a little different. But, yeah, I just loved it. It was a great tour.
Yeah, I imagine, too. I mean, obviously, just the maneuverability of it, being able to fly slow and really like that. That's pretty cool aspect of the Hornet.
It was pretty amazing how slow you could get that thing and still have full control, you know. But there are downsides to that, too. You know, it departed often.
Really?
There's a pretty good, because we weren't limited by AOA at all.
Right.
So we were G limited, but not alpha limited. So yeah, if you got beyond the alpha, boy, it you know, point one way, point the other way, and then snap around and do this falling leaf thing that could be pretty disconcerting.
Yeah, slightly. That's why I like the Viper. It's like, just pull as hard as you can, and then when it can't do it anymore, it's going to say, nope, you're too dumb. I'm not going to do that.
No, John, yeah.
You won't be able to handle this. So
that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I did one quick story. It was my fighter upgrade with a buddy of mine, and he was, you know, instructing me on how to be an instructor. And so it was two instructors going out. It was a great time. And we did a lot of bantering, so, you know, Air Force, Navy, blah, 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 you know. And he was a Hornet baby. He had 3,000 hours of Hornet, you know. Yeah. And I wasn't really an air-to-air guy anyway. Right. And I, you know, and I 60 hours in the Hornet. But I, of course, I told him I was going to kick his butt.
Yeah, naturally.
That's right. So we go to a high aspect meet in the middle, and everyone said, he always goes down, so I'm going up. So I was going to be, you know, Mr. Different, go up. So I point that nose, that Hornet, straight up, and I'm looking for him, and I lose him. It was the Key West, so over the water, you know, like, I lose him. But then I got a little distracted, got slow, and you know, I'm, you know, worst place to be, to like this, you know, slow. And it just boom, the parts, and just starts swinging and falling leaf. And the best thing to do is just, you know, grab onto the handles, the towel rack, not the ejection, but the handles up on the canopy bow, you know.
Just let it go.
Let it go and ride it out. And lucky, if it gets bad enough, it'll tell you, you know, push the stick left or push the stick right, or, you know, but it didn't get that bad. But, man, I was sure, you know, he couldn't track that, I'll tell you.
I was going to say, that's a pretty tough target to hit.
That's right. That was my plan all along.
Take this thing and I'm going to take it out of control.
Yeah, that's right. Never expect that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but that was it was a great airplane though. And the carrier qual deal was I'd always wanted to do that, but I just didn't really want to be in a Navy guy. So.
Yeah. Yep. Too same. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So it was good to see you both. You know.
Yeah. 5 days is perfect.
Exactly. It was exactly perfect. And usually I got to fly a jet off, you know, so fly a jet home. And so that was nice. But yeah, it was really, really neat. So after I got carrier qualified, you know, I really enjoyed it. And I got a phone call at 6 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday. The Air Force doesn't fly on Sundays, right?
That's right.
So it was my squadron commander, who was a fire breathing, dyed in the wool naval aviator. And he personally slammed my Navy wings on my chest when I got qualified. And he was just a great guy, great leader. He became a four-star admiral later. But anyway, he calls me up and says, "Mainline, you know, you want to go bag traps this morning?" And bagging traps is going around the pattern, just landing on the ship over and over and over again, you know, because the Navy, the amount of traps you have is, you know, makes you King Kong or not.
Yeah,
I guess
that's a big deal. They always put it in their bio, like, it's
that's right.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, this is
180 traps.
I,
So the answer, because I wanted to fly his jet still and his squadron, the answer was absolutely, sir. I can't think of anything I'd rather do this Sunday morning, you know, which I just got back. I didn't make a fool out of myself too bad. You know, yeah. I didn't bend any metal. And I go, man, maybe I should just quit while I'm ahead. But the answer was, of course, yes, I want to go. So anyway, we went out. And the Stennis was doing a shakedown, and it was a buddy of his was the captain. And he called him up and said, hey, you want to, you know, because they need a certain amount of landings right. to certify their ship. So we went out of the sixth ship of Hornets and got, I got 10 landings, you know. And so now I had 26 total landings on a ship. And I go, shoot, that's a quarter of the way to being a Centurion, which is a big thing. You know?
Yeah, I mean, get a patch.
So I volunteered to be, they call it the tower fire, which is like in the Air Force, the soft supervisor of flying. Basically, you stand up in the tower with the air boss, who's a crusty, angry, you know, lieutenant colonel running the show, you know, up there. And if the students that we had students, you know, were qualifying, had either an emergency, you read them the book, tell them what to do, tell them to divert, give them the information or give them advice, blah, blah. Or the boss, air boss, would yell at you for something they did that was stupid. So you're kind of
perfect.
Perfect. So none of the Navy guys really wanted to do it, you know. So I, you know, because they'd been on the cruise and I had. So I'd go up there in my brown boots, my Navy right. wings, my blue Air Force rank. The one boss goes, look at me with some expletives. Deleted said, looked me from foot, you know, head to foot, and goes, what the hell are you? I'm your Navy Exchange. Air Force Exchange.
Happy to be here. Happy to serve.
So I would do that. And then if there was time and an airplane available, I'd run down someone to replace me and I'd go around the pattern, get 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes landings. So I did that. And I did that, you know, over my 3 years to where, I mean, my goal was to try to get 100 landings. But then I got the idea, better than 100 is 101. Because then at the bar, I can always say, I got well over 100 traps. It's no big deal, you know. and I wouldn't be lying, you know.
Fact.
One more than 100 is well over 100 on this business. So, my last deployment before I was rotating back to the Air Force, I needed like 7 landings, which is quite a few. And I got like one day I got 3. So then the next day I needed 4 before it went down. Everything was winding down. And this air boss particular guy was a crusty old Navy guy. I was up there, you know, I'm doing my tour. And I said, hey, boss, I think I'm going to get able to get some landings, you know, but I really need 5, you know. I really, really need 5. This is my last tour, you know. Can you make that happen? And he looks at me and he goes, well, I'm grabbing. Why do you need 5? And I go, well, because that'll make 101. And he kind of looks at me funny and goes, why would you want 101 when wouldn't you want to stop at 100, make a nice run there? I go, no, in the bar, I can say I got well over 100 drafts. He thought that was pretty funny. He goes, oh, well, you know, but, you know, I'll see what we can do, you know. Okay. So I get the call. Okay, you can go. So I came down, ran, get my stuff together, and ran back up and got in a jet. And I was the only one out there. And so he put me on, I think, the furthest starboard cat. It's on the right side. Starboard cat 4. Yeah, I can't remember now how they're numbered. But anyway, and launched me off. And of course, I had aileron into the turn. You know, on going down the cat track, so I could make it fast. You know, so boom, I'm off in the turn to downwind. You know, and hooked down, getting all trimmed up, blah, 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 doing all my stuff. Going around into the groove. Boom, land. And they usually would take you to the far right catapult starboard. But now they're taking me to the number 2. I think it was number right to left. So cat 2, which in the wires was like 2 seconds, you know. And then he hooks up, you turn, boom, settles down, you know, or launch bars down, and then you're into boom. And then so it was too fast for an Air Force guy, yeah. You know. But I went and I did it and got my, now I go, okay, got launched for my 5th one, my 101st. But I go, you know, I don't care if I get 102 or 3 or 4. I just want over 100. So I'm having fun. But I land on my my last one to get 101. And they would call you by the side number on your airplane, you know, 330, 332, whatever. And so the boss goes, hey, 330, how many traps do you have? And I go, well over 100, boss. He goes,
good, you're done. Except me, chalked me and chained me, and that was it. And that was my last Navy landing.
That's awesome.
On a carrier. So I was on the JFK, which is being decommissioned now. But yeah, pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's my – I got a couple other good Navy stories, but I know you got to go.
Ah, that's awesome. I know we've just like ping-ponged around here with your career, but you wrapped up active duty flying the F-4.
Right.
And so you did a flying German F-4s, which I imagine was instructing, and then wrapped mm-hmm. up doing the drone F-4s. What was it like going, I guess, man, I mean, just between 810 to the F-117 to the Hornet, back to the F-117, and then to the F-4. I mean, you're stepping through the decades.
Yeah. Yeah, I went backwards. I ended up in the oldest airplane in the inventory. It was really, you know, I'm an airplane guy. I like airplanes. You know, I my goal was to fly as many different airplanes in the military as I could and achieved it, which is not an easy thing to do.
No.
Now, I didn't become a general, which.
But you're happy and look at you now.
I'm happy and look at me now. Exactly right. And I probably couldn't have ever been one anyway. So that's all good. So I it was great. I mean, I loved every airplane I got to fly. You know, everyone goes, well, what was your favorite one? I go, well, you know, A-10 was great because of the gun and doing this. Oh, the Hornet was great. You know, I name them all. And they're once old wise guy told me, you know, when I asked what was his favorite, he goes, the one I'm in, you know,
yeah.
The one I'm flying at the time. So that's kind of how I feel.
Yeah, that's incredible. Incredible aviation story. We didn't even talk about Warbirds, but I mean, I know Mustang, Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
What else have you been? I know you've recently got checked out a few more too.
Yeah, I'm rated in the Mustang, the P-47, the F-4U Corsair, the AD-1 Sky Raider, the SBD Dauntless, TBM Avenger, B-25, the B-17. Let's see.
Yeah, I mean, and you're building a T-6 right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. Just a jack of all trades, especially when it comes to aviation.
Don't say the second part of that phrase.
I left it off intentionally because.
Very nice of you. Yeah.
Again, it's $20. Yeah. It's going to get expensive.
That's right. Exactly. It is. Yeah. Short attention span, I guess, or maybe ADHD or whatever. But the more the merrier. So. Yeah, I've been very, very lucky. It's not lost on me how lucky and fortunate. I wanted to do that ever since, you know, I was a little kid. The Mustang, the P-40, so those were all my favorite. If I could have joined a military, you know, when I was an adult to fly those, I would have. You know, jets were just the next best thing. So it's great to be able to do it later.
Yeah, that's incredible. Dude, I like to wrap up each podcast and ask, you know, the guest, if you found 15, 16-year-old Tuna walking the streets, would you have any advice for him, any recommendations mm-hmm. or changes?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, you can do anything, you know. Every good parent tells his child, you know, there's nothing you can't do. And it's true, largely. I mean, it's largely true. But there's always barriers, you know, and my kind of advice, and I gave this to my son, who's an F-16 pilot now, and I said, you know, you gotta beat on each door, knock it down, and some of them won't be easy to beat down, and some will be, but you gotta just go until you get to the steel, you know, door that won't, but you still gotta beat on it, because you just never know. So there's always obstacles and things that try to push you away from that goal. And dissuade you and discourage you and try to, you know, whether it's a physical thing, a mental thing, you know, whatever. But if you want it bad enough, you just keep pushing and it'll happen.
I love it. Perfect way to wrap up the podcast.
Right.
Tuna, thank you for your time. Thank you for your service. Thank you for everything you've done. It's great calling you a friend. I really enjoyed flying with you. Hopefully we get to fly again soon, one of these days.
I hope so too, Rain. And thanks for having me. It was quite the pleasure.
Absolutely.
And thanks for your service, too.
Thank you.
Enjoyed flying with you.
It was fun. Thanks again for listening. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Be back in 2 weeks with another round.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.